Thank you so much. After hearing all that, I'm dying to hear what I have to say. It's too bad mothers go home to the Lord so soon, because they're the only ones that would appreciate that hard work of yours to put all that together. But it is a joy to be back home, and I say that truly because of the 29 years we spent at TED's and with the wonderful joy that we had of teaching there. Many of my students will be interested to know, yes, I did teach the Old Testament, but I have since read the New. I want to report to you, I like it very much. It reminds me of the old. It is just a delight to take a portion of the scriptures that are generally not preached on too much and used, and to bring that to the attention of God's people. And I still think preaching is what changes the world. And it's the greatest calling on planet Earth. I don't care. It's true. It's not recognized here. But you ought to see in heaven, they're making a very good record. And it is gone down. Well, in South Korea now, when I've gone to South Korea, they treat you like you were the king. Preacher is number two profession in that land, and they act that way. They really do. But at any rate, enough of that. Let's get into the text itself. I want to talk about this whole business of creation and science. It is a huge, huge topic. I have with me the Journal of the American Scientific Affiliation, which is an evangelical outfit. And this is the September 2010 issue, volume 62, number 3. And out of all of these articles, only one comes close to what we would call a traditional position. The end of October, I was here in Austin, and they had what was called, a very strange title, The Vibrant Dance of Faith and Science. I never saw the dance, but we did talk about faith and science, and it was done by the Hill Country Institute. And I participated October 26th to 28, 2010, in about six panels. With scientists and also with theologians. Between reading this and being at that conference, I'm alarmed. I really think that one of the top issues in days ahead is going to be, so much so I've said, okay, that's another book. And so I'm going to try to take about a dozen and a half texts that are on creation and take us to them and do the only kind of preaching you remember is expository preaching. I was going to save this for later on, but I went back to Trinity. They invited me back a few years ago to a D-Min. Not demon, but D-Min. You must slow down as you say that, Doctor of Ministry. And there were 30 pastors who had about 17 years average experience, and they were in about a dozen and a half different churches. And I began and I said, what we need today is expository preaching. Every place I've seen throughout the two-thirds world, it is prospering and the churches are growing. Wherever I've seen it in the United States, the churches are prospering. I know there are 1,000 other antidotes, but this one is powerful. It has behind it the power of the Word of God, the promise of God's Holy Spirit, and also the real results that are coming in all over the world. This is one of the greatest moments for the church on planet Earth. In the two-thirds world, I mean everything outside of Western Europe, Canada, and the United States, with exceptions of your church, but I mean all the rest. I'm just sharing this as a prayer request. But all the rest are in just a real need. But in those places, the gospel is going ahead. I mean, the largest number who are coming to Christ, we have a little sort of resource center. They just produced at my former institution a Atlas of Christianity, Oxford Press. It's an expensive little baby, $250. But it is worth it, as it speaks of where are the centers of each of the movements of Christianity. And some 2 million new people have come to believe in Jesus Christ in the last 10 years or so. And the largest number are Islamic Arabs. And how so? Through a vision of Jesus. And through that vision of Jesus, they go and ask, how are we going to find this Jesus? And they're led to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and are truly converted. This story is happening, 60,000 in Iran, 70,000 in Iraq, 1.5 million in Sudan, which has just voted for independence in the southern part, 1,500 in Turkey, 800 in Tunisia and Morocco. I mean, it just keeps going. Where are the weak spots? Where the gospel had its rootage? Western Europe, the old Reformation countries. So that as the gospel began in Jerusalem, went up to Antioch, and we're talking about geographical center, as many people north as south as east as west. And it kept going up into, during the Reformation period, it was up into the northern Europe, and then started a southern thing, went down to Spain, and in 1900, crossed over the Rock of Gibraltar and went into Africa and continued on a kind of 5 o'clock, 45 degree, cutting across Africa. And the center of Christianity right now, many east is west, north, south, Timbuktu, literally. That's the absolute center right now of all believers. But at any rate, back to the real topic here today, Genesis and science. I believe, we say in the Apostles' Creed, in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. Well, it's about time we proclaim those texts on what it is to announce that this one is maker of heaven and earth. Some of our colleagues, I'm not here to tell tales. You'll just have to get this and read it for yourself. But people that that should really know better have come up here with their conclusions. And their conclusions is, considering the evidence presented here, he said, here's what we have, a shift from the traditional understanding of the Genesis record to now more reliable scientific information. And it is saying that we do not have a single Adam and Eve, but we have at least 10,000 individuals of animals that we were derived from. So that leaves the question, how shall we speak theologically of Adam and Eve? Now, there is one good guy that wears a good hat in here, and I'll come to him later on. But let me begin with the theme here, which is Genesis chapter 1. I want to stay there for a while, so why not open to that particular text? And those of you who were in Hebrew class, remember Did we remember? Did we memorize that, didn't we? Bereshit bara Elohim eight hashemayim ve'eit ha'aretz. In the beginning, full stop, tifka. God created the heavens and the earth. And period. An absolute beginning is not a spiritual luxury here. An absolute beginning for the composition of the universe is stated clearly in the biblical text. Oh, someone says, yes, but it doesn't say in the beginning. Yeah, technically you're correct because of the adverbial expressions in Hebrew, they don't take that there. But on the other hand, if you want Origen's Hexapla, in which he used Greek letters to bring over what he saw as the Hebrew, he gave a full long A, so he read in his text, in the beginning. But our biblical text just simply states that God is the maker of the universe. There is no Hebrew word for universe. Heavens and earth is the whole nine yards. So in the beginning, God created the whole universe. That's the claim here. The word heaven and earth, there is a hendiatis, one concept, hen, dia, dis, two. One versus two, one by means of two. So in the beginning, God created the whole universe. So the first great principle here is an absolute beginning, which is contrary to all the ancient schools of philosophy, which usually held that matter was eternal. Epicurus, for example, this will just be briefly, so bear with me for a minute. No, first of all, said Epicurus, that nothing can spring from non-entity. Nothing? Then he hadn't read Genesis. Plato, too, another Greek, who said that matter was coexistent with God. It was. Then there are two gods, and there is dualism here. But biblical Christianity affirmed that the universe had a beginning, and the Christian church believed, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. So we said every Sunday, or did we used to say? But at any rate, according to the Apostles' Creed, all variations of spontaneous combustion or the eternality of matter were decisively anti-biblical because they went against the message of Scripture. Reality, according to the classic Greek philosophers, was interpreted either in terms of being or in terms of becoming. Even though the Greeks held that there were two alternate ultimate principles, deity and process, they avoided combining being-becoming, which type of combination of the two tended to come later in history and to be adopted as a outside of Christianity. But it's precisely this exclusive definition of reality that is incompatible with supernaturalism, even in such a form as is seen in the polite provision whereby the system of becoming is espoused along with the presence of some kind of first cause. However, such demoting of God to some sort of abstract first cause posture strikes at the heart of a personal God. My favorite expression in the biblical text is the living God. I love that one. 14 times in the New Testament, told you I read it, and 14 times in the Old Testament, tie score. Living God. My favorite is in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, how that you turn from idols to serve the true and, here it comes, living God. God is alive. God is person. God is real. My favorite in the Old Testament is 1 Samuel 17. Davy was told to take some cheeses up to his brothers, three brothers who were fighting the Philistines, and to their commander, must have been from Wisconsin. But at any rate, he took these cheeses up, and out comes this nine-foot dude, and he says, "Give me a man, I want to fight." Could have been one of your church members. "Give me a man, I want to fight," which summarizes some of the problem persons. But at any rate, and he starts demeaning and belittling the name of God. And Davey says, "He can't do that." His brother said, "Oh, shut up. Go back with those miserable sheep." You know, brother talk. I'm giving you marginal readings here, but it summarizes it pretty well. But at any rate, Davey said, "Let me at him." And first he asked, "Where are the 30 valiant heroes? Where's Jonathan? Where's Saul?" "Oh, they're going to be heroes tomorrow." But they've been saying that for 6 weeks now, 40 days. And he tried on Saul's armor. He said, "Let me out of this tin can." And he went and picked up five stones. Why five stones? There are pastors that know. I don't. As a matter of fact, we had a commencement speaker. I won't mention Chuck's name at all. But at any rate, he knew it. Each one of the five, he took them out of the pouch and put them on the podium for graduation. Well, at any rate, I think he picked up five because that's all he could hold. And he put one in that sling and wound that baby up. And he said, "Mister," I think that's where you throw your leg. "Mister, I come to you in the name of the living God." Now, that was a thought that never struck Goliath in that way. It made an impression on him that God was living, the living God. That's what I like about this. The Greeks were way off. And the biblical text wants us, tell men and women, please, would you, that our God is alive and well, and he's person, and he knows the story and knows what's going on. Well, at any rate, this first cause strikes at the heart of a personal divine government, and on the other hand, at the providence in nature. Nature is not just thrown together. What we would call accident, or that it was something that happened just by luck. Luck? How would a Christian refer to luck? In 1 Samuel, remember, they had that story about they captured the ark of God, brought it into Dagon's temple, and Dagon fell over out cold, right in front. Matter of fact, came apart. Can you imagine a Philistine coming to Dagon for worship services and heavy heart? "Oh, Dagon, 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 Dagon!" There he was. Pagans should always go to worship with Elmer's glue. That's a principle that is there. I've forgotten where it's Hesitations 1-2 or somewhere around there. But at any rate, it is there. Well, the Hebrew Masoretes focused in on this first word, in beginning. And they put a little mark underneath of it, which was full break, full stop. Bereshit. And it had a disjunctive accent marker called a tifka, indicating in the beginning. That's how you read it. Full stop. God created the heavens, nearly created the universe. So we begin at the very beginning of this mega story of the Bible, that the grand plan that puts the whole scripture together. It starts with God. God, who is maker of heaven and earth. And therefore, I think that needs to come about. Now, the second great, if an absolute beginning is the first great principle that we ought to teach theologically, then the second great principle comes immediately, where it stresses the creation narrative, also records the method. Oh my, am I so agitated over those well-meaning evangelical Christians that say, well, the Bible tells us that God created, but it doesn't tell us how. Well, please, ladies and gentlemen, what did the Holy Spirit do for the next two chapters? Stutter? I mean, there is more story than verse 1. It goes on to say how. And you have to be, excuse me, I shouldn't say this. My mother told me never say it, but I'm going to say it anyhow because I want to communicate. You have to be a dummy to miss it. And God said, and God said, and God said, Vayomer Elohim, Vayomer Elohim, Vayomer Elohim, 10 times over. So tell me, can you give me a hint how God made the world? Yes, he spoke it into existence. Ah, you say, give me a worship psalm that says that. Yeah, Psalm 33, verse 6 and 9. By the word of the Lord were the heavens formed. And that word of God is a powerful originating word. And so I want us to get the second great principle. Not only there's an absolute start. There was only God, and then he made the universe. Then secondly, the method was by his word. Now, why is it that we have no trouble when we come to Matthew chapter 8? The nobleman comes and says, Lord, look, my servant is sick, but I know who you are. And I'm a man who has authority, and I have people under me. I say to them, go, and they go, and they come, and come. Lord, speak the word. Don't bother coming to my house. Jesus marvels. Where did this nobleman get this? So he spoke the word. He said, go home. He went home, and he said, when did he get better? And the answer was, same time that Jesus spoke the word. So we say, oh, it's the powerful word of Jesus. All right. So what about the powerful word of Jesus in Genesis 1? Come on. Same thing. Matthew 8, Genesis 1. So I plead with the church, please be fair. Do in the Old Testament what you do in the New Testament. Passages, Matthew 8, verses 5 through 13. And moreover, John's gospel takes a similar stance. He says, in the beginning was the Word. Yeah, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Oh, yeah, both. He was with God in the beginning, and through him all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that was made. John 1, 1 through 2. Surely this points to the direct hand of our Lord Jesus in particular in all that currently appears on earth and in heaven. But then I must come to verse 2, because besides saying the fact that God had an absolute beginning when there was nothing, no universe, nothing at all, and then there was, and then his method he created by his word, and then darkness. Now, the earth was tohu vavohu, which is our hurdy-gurdy, boogie-woogie construction there. Tohu vavohu. Sounds bad. And it is. And vahoshek, darkness was up over the face of the deep. And the ruach Elohim, the spirit of God, was murahefet, was hovering over the waters. Now, with the good creation just stated in verse 1, coming from the hand of God, how was it that what immediately follows such a majestic announcement of an absolute beginning from the hand of God that it can be depicted with such negativity, namely formless, empty, dark, and the Spirit of God hovering over the waters. Had not Jude 6, any chapter in Jude will do, but I'm thinking of verse 6, mentions, that's New Testament, the angels did not keep their position of authority, but abandoned their own home. These God had kept in darkness, bound with everlasting chains for judgment on that great day. Likewise, 2 Peter 2:4 said, God did not spare the angels when they sinned, but sent them to hell, putting them into gloomy dungeons to be held for judgment. Now, did both passages point to a heavenly disturbance? And did this exile from heaven take place prior to the arrival of Adam and Eve on the scene and in a perfect garden where they must have their goodness tested? Some think so. And after all, where did the serpent come from? Now, the serpent always has the article, han-nachash. So it has the article before nachash. Why the serpent? And where does he get such smarts? Because he said, surely God knows in the day you eat of it, you'll be wise, like gods. I think that is nothing less, not speaking of the shape or the form of the appearance of the evil one, but his title, as he is known in the book of Revelation, that old serpent, the dragon, Satan, the devil. And I think that it is the devil himself who comes and talks to the woman. Had it been an animal talking to her, generally the biblical text takes special note and says it was an animal. But there's no indication here. And so Lucifer, along with other angelic beings, revolted in heaven, and that revolt had brought darkness, sin, evil, death, and pain that began apparently to invade the universe. Or why this verse 2? Now the earth was formless and empty. How can you say that after in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth? It seems to me like an interruption there. It may be, but I still have to account for the presence of at least evil, whether I've identified the shape as being Satan correctly or not, but there is evil in the garden in the form of this suggestion. And it says to Eve, look, try it. You'll like it. In effect, that was the marginal reading. And so she took it and gave it to Adam. And that dummy never said anything. He just ate. He just chomped on the thing. So I have nothing to say for my gender. But at any rate, he just ate of the whole thing. So because of illusions of this sort, it seems possible to conclude that even prior to the fall of Adam and Eve, there must have been a celestial disturbance of some sort in which Lucifer, along with other angelic beings, revolted. And that's where we have some sort of leftover references to this in Jude 6 and in 2 Peter 2:4. But at any rate, the whole concept here is very important. Perhaps this is how the second verse of Genesis fits into what otherwise was a magnificent creation of the universe by the triune God. Many interpreters have rightly pointed to Isaiah 14. How are you fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn? You have been cast down. And I know that's written there to the king of Babylon, and later on in Ezekiel 28, verse 11 through 19, written to the king of Tyre. But they are local manifestations, the now of a not yet. And therefore, they may be continuing. So while the text does not indicate where in time this event or any of the others discussed here are given, the concept of darkness and waste and void that suddenly appear on earth make it assume that something happened even prior to the fall of Adam and Eve. But that takes us on to the literary type. What literary genre is found in Genesis 1 through 11? And in a paper that I prepared for the 20th anniversary of the Evangelical Theological Society in 1967, there I had argued that the author of Genesis intended that the events described in 1 through 11 should be treated much as they were in Genesis 12 through 50. As a matter of fact, it had the same kind of rubric or heading that the second part had. It went like this. These are the generations of the heaven and earth. These are the generations of Adam. These are the generations of Noah, so forth. Six times in chapters 1 through 11. And in Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, we had four more times. These are the generations of Terah. These are the generations of Isaac. In other words, the second part, which we know so well of the patriarchs, and where we have found so much historical background backing it up, is very much the writer intended us to treat the first part as being real happenings. Now, that does not mean that there wasn't also some symbolic or figurative language. After all, if you try to read their figures of speech, a wonderful book that I think every pastor should have on their list there by E.W. Bullinger. Bullinger was a very extreme dispensationalist and figured that nothing belonged to us until the end of the book of Acts. Then our material began after that. That used to be a great theme in the Evangelical Free Church before my days and before they joined together in 1950. But E.W. Bullinger, in that book, Figures of Speech, still printed by Baker, has given to us 8,000 illustrations of figurative language in the Old and New Testaments, analyzed by 240 figures of speech, where it gives a definition, gives a Greek and Roman classical example, and then gives the biblical examples. A beautiful artifact to have on your shelves. But at any rate, it lists quite a number, about 150 figures of speech in the Genesis 1 through 11. But on the other hand, there is a huge amount of very straightforward material that can be found in the material that is found there. For example, in Genesis 1 through 11, there are 88 personal names, 48 generic names, 21 cultural items such as gold, bdellium, onyx, brass, iron, gopher wood, bitumen, mortar, brick, stone, harp, pipe, along with that. And the single chapter of Genesis 10, which this fact was pointed out by Wilbur Smith, I think it was, that the single chapter in Genesis 10 of Genesis had five times the geographical and cultural and historical data found in the entire Quran. Five times. Where in Genesis 1 through 11, and there just Genesis 10 stuck its neck out five more times than the 150 surahs that are found or chapters in the whole Quran. So at any rate, that needs to be brought. But now let's come to the really difficult matter. And now I begin to take my jacket off because now we come to the real work here. And this is the historicity of Adam and Eve. Now the word historical, if you're going to use it like scholars use it today in history books, that has a very, very nuanced meaning. But if you mean by history that it points to actual events in ordinary language, yes. The record of the narrative of Adam and Eve is one that is historical and therefore speaks of an original couple. Now, that's the one that evangelical churches, evangelical colleges, evangelical seminaries in the next 5 years will be put hard to task on that because of the Geno Project by Francis Collins. You must, as pastors, you must, I know you don't have time, but it's too important. You must read Francis Collins' book, The Language of God. Francis Collins is an evangelical Christian, but he also espouses what I think is wrong, and that is theistic evolution. And he wants God's people to get on board so that we don't look like benighted fools. And so he has created a group and a website called BioLogos. BioLogos. And that's worth looking up, where he, along with some very, very important evangelicals, some you heard of in October, my good friend, former Dallas faculty member, then Westminster, then Regent, and then more recently RTS, Bruce Walkie, came out and they put it on ABC News. Well, this was news. An evangelical says we better catch up and join theistic evolution. Now, what that sounds like two good words if they're properly nuanced, but he didn't mean that. He meant that God is the one who used the evolutionary process. So there was God, and then apparently he stood back and let the whole process that Darwin speaks of take over. Now, that wasn't what James Orr and B.B. Warfield meant in when they spoke of this in the early part of the 1900s. They were holding back the whole pressure of critical scholarship, and so they bent some, and they said, look, there are three times in the narrative where it says God bara, God created. There are three terms used in the record there, yatsar to form, asa to make, and bara to create. 45 times it occurs in the Bible, but always means to create a new thing without agency of material. That much is clear. And God is usually the author or the subject of that verb. So in Genesis, it occurs in verse 1, God created the heavens and the earth. And then it occurs in verse 21, so God created the great creatures of the sea. And it is said there that God created life. And then in verse 27, God created man in his own image. So James Orr and Augustus Hopkins Strong and Benjamin Breckinridge Warfield, some greats who are in heaven right now and probably are wincing as I tell you this if they're listening in over the balustrade. But at any rate, they said in these three places, God stepped in and said, brand new, create the universe. Then he let it go, and then he said, we need life. And so he got a hopping thing along and pushed life in it. And then he got a chimpanzee or something like that, and put the image of God in, stood up straight, got a razor, and with Gillette started shaving himself and said, "Me, Adam." But something like that. I'm just giving you a mock-up case here. But they said three places God intervened. Well, now theistic evolution is really deistic evolution. God wound the whole process up and let it go. And we can't have an arrival even of a single pair. It takes, according to genome studies, something like 10,000 individuals. Well, that's going to work a lot of difficulty for Romans 5, as by one man, so by another, or 1 Corinthians 15, which also has the same thing, by one, so by another. Well, ladies and gentlemen, theology is on the line. Our younger members of our congregation are being put through the mill. The studies that are here in the Genome Project are amazing, I must tell you. And the results that they're bringing in some medical relief for individuals is also amazing. But there need to be real answers to them too as well. I don't think that my good friend Bruce, and he went public, so that's why I feel free to mention his name, but when he said, look, we've got to get ahead of the curve, we've always been behind it, let's say there was theistic evolution, that's how God created the world. Well, RTS asked for his resignation that same day, and wonder of wonders, Knox College, Jim Kennedy, turned around and hired him. Same day. So go figure. But at any rate, what is the issue here with this whole business? And I could go and give you some of the background. I reread again this morning many of the essays. They're impressive essays. The whole business of how they put things together they're possible, but I don't think it's the final answer. For example, we said when we had comparative morphology, and they put on the page of my book when I went to 10th grade, they said, look, here is the wing of a bat, here is the leg of an animal, and here's the arm of a man. And they said, similarity implies common descent. And we said, no. And I wrote back to my teacher and gave him the same outline, put a new thing underneath it that said, similarity implies common designer. It's a Frank Lloyd Wright. You can always tell his buildings. And you can always tell God's work, too. So there are similarities. Okay, so the chimp has 1.5 difference in all of the millions of genes that we share, and often in the same order, yes. But I still say built by the same designer. It was still God that built that. Well, some of our people... whom you know and are part of our fellowship apparently, have said no. No, that can't be. So to argue Adam and Eve were just symbols or mythic representations, as some want to do here, of the whole human race, rather than historic individuals, would put us at odds with Jesus in Mark 10:6. But at the beginning of creation, he made them male and female, and the two should become one flesh. It was God that made male, God that made female, and God who made them one flesh. Biblically, it's a biblical statement. And not to tempt that and take that into the pulpit and say, brothers and sisters in Christ, you are beautifully and wonderfully made. I've got to speak in our Free Church in Sheboygan on Sunday for Human Life Sunday, and I'm going to speak on Psalm 139 and Exodus 21. But it says here, my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret places. Each one of us, God knew us while we were being stitched and knitted together in our mother's womb. And he said, your eyes saw my, and now the NIV says, unformed body. Come on, guys. It says, gold me. You saw my embryo, and God loved me. There, that's worth 10 sessions at $125 an hour. Do you have personal worth? Yes. Before you knew day one, guess who was really taken with you and me? God. He loved us. And we hadn't done stitch number one there. That'll tell you self-worth. And no wonder the psalmist says, how precious to me are your thoughts, O Lord. How vast is the sum of them? Yeah, if I were to count them, they would outnumber the grains of the sand. When I awake, I am still with you. So, for people with a sad sense of who they are, you are something because God loved you way before you were born. You know that? And he was there as you were being knitted together in your mother's womb. So such symbolic designation would also mean that we would be at odds with the Apostle Paul in Romans 5:12. If Adam was just as real a man, so Jesus was. The rejoinder that comes back is that these biblical authors were merely persons of their times who used all sorts of methods to teach readers, to include the traditions of the day. But that puts us again outside the biblical text. Unless there's a unity of all mortals in Adam, we could have some mortals who might be outside the federal representation that Adam had for us. And such a claim is a foundation to what Christianity is and claims, both federally and paternally. So the key to determining is to return back to the author's sense and meaning. And that really is the basis for what we have here. Well, there's a lot more that I could say. In the intellectual capital of the day, Athens, the Apostle Paul preached on Mars Hill, the God who made the world and everything that is in it is Lord of heaven and earth. From one man, he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole world. Acts 17:24-26. Thus, while some determined that the manner in which Eve is spoken of being formed by God from a rib taken from Adam's side, must be understood as some sort of a looser view, yet the biblical text says even with the symbol, it is that she was taken and built, bana, built by God from something that was part of Adam so that they had a family resemblance, a family propinquity. And that's more than a federal argument. So at this point, it's necessary to ask, on what basis was the selection made of one or more of the emerging primates in which it was decided to affix the image of God? And Genesis 1:27 merely declares, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. While this image is difficult to define, yet it's not impossible. Adam and Eve spoke from the very start. Speech. Adam and Eve could love from the very start. Love is part of the image of God. Adam was given a dominion, and he was a dominion haver. So therefore, like God has dominion, Adam had dominion. And furthermore, in Colossians 3:10, it said, renewed in knowledge after the image of him who created us. So knowledge was part of it. And in Ephesians 4:25-26, renewed in righteousness and holiness after the image of him who created us. So the Bible hasn't left us without a witness at all. But therefore, I think that the designation theistic or deistic evolution as a new watchword misses the point amazingly. God created all matter from the beginning. And God created all life from the beginning. And God put a distinction in Adam and Eve and in all their descendants, which was the image of God. That's why people are not like animals, because they're made in God's image. Therefore, on another matter, there's evidence for, yes, a microevolution, that is, there is development from species to genus to family to order, but nothing that makes the evolutionary theory work, which is class, phyla, kingdom. We've never seen any evidence for that, whether it be in the forms that come from working in anthropology, or whether there be forms that come in even the latest research that we have, which is in genes. I think we've got to go back and help God's people with series that would say, I believe in the God who made heaven and earth, the whole universe. And that's the thrust of what I would like to give you. I've not given a lot of the scientific evidence here, deliberately cut a lot of that out, because I still think that we as teachers and preachers ought to get the biblical evidence before we get the scientific evidence. But nevertheless, both can be correlated. Even the latest statements that are coming from Francis Collins, who set up the whole of BioLogos. One of the leaders in that, a very fine man whom all of us look to, Tim Keller, has written a paper in which he participated in BioLogos and takes it for Genesis 1, but then tries to say, let's have an absolute beginning with Adam and Eve, because he sees the theological implications from Romans 5 and 1 Corinthians 15. So, are these exciting days? Oh, yeah. But do they demand the best from us? Yes. You say, I'm not up to this. Yeah, but your kids and grandkids will be. And they'll press the questions. And therefore, we ought to be readers and be reading along with them as best we can to try to give some of these answers. Let's go into Q&A time here now.
Let's do this first. Let's thank Dr. Kaiser.
Yes.
And you've framed that very well, and it is a very important issue to address and understand. as you have heard, read, that the statistics of numbers of young people that leave home, go to college, they leave the faith completely. Now, we understand statistics and surveys and whatnot, but we've got to prepare them. This is, I think, one of the critical areas in which they need to be prepared. Well, let's transition to questions. One in the back, one up here first, and then Ruben.
Sure. I would like to ask if you could speak on the accounts that were in ancient literature, Babylonian, Egyptian, and other kinds that are similar to the Genesis account. That seems to put a huge bug in the young generation. And how? Why do we have them? What's different? What does that mean? How do we respond to them?
Yeah, I've worked through them. That was part of my graduate studies, to read those things in the Akkadian and in the Egyptian and in the other ones. The only ones I didn't read were in Arabic, but all the other languages, I think I did see them. And by and large, there are very, very few similarities. John Walton has done a book in which he really has argued that there are quite a few similarities, but as I read through it, and as my earlier article back in 1967, which came out in New Perspectives on the Old Testament, edited by Barton Payne, and that was published in 1970, and it's called The Literary Genre of Genesis 1 through 11. And I try to take up each one of those stories. The so-called triple-deckered universe, that there is an underworld with pillars, then a flat earth, and then a vault over top of it, which there holds through which stars and rain and also blessings come in the book of Malachi, is really far-fetched. The word rakiach is a word, just means an expanse. And so I argued that the so-called triple-deckered universe, which you see in all the liberal books, I just say nine nix nipa niet, as strongly as I can, but with evidence there of meeting them. And I take up about a dozen of those stories, of the so-called Cain-Abel story and so forth along with them, but each one of them has to be taken up individually, and we don't have enough time to really deal with that here, but that's just a general question to it. Oh, someone back here? Yes, thanks.
Yes, am I understanding that both Walkey and Keller have embraced theistic evolution with Keller a modification there? Am I understanding you
correctly? Keller modifies it on Adam and Eve. He came out with a strong paper on the historicity of Adam and Eve because of the federal headship of Adam, and therefore, and Romans 5 and 1 Corinthians 15. So I was very glad for that. But he cooperates with him and says that's how the original creation came. But he breaks it off and has God create two historic individuals. Those are two strong leaders in our day. And that is going to set a huge pace for an awful lot of young people.
And I suspect that at some point they offer their evidence for why they hold for what they hold. Is that
yes,
in that same
yes.
book?
And go online to biologos.org, I think it is. And is that correct? Okay. Yeah. And you'll get more information there. But these are two godly men. We're going to share heaven with them, so don't throw them out of the synagogue. But on the other hand, I just regret it. And both have gone public. Tim has written a very, very good paper on Adam and Eve. I've forgotten where that one appears, but I've worked through that, and I was very satisfied.
So somehow evolution was occurring at some point, and God went in and gave him the image of God.
And that was my question. Tim, why don't you make it clear? How do you break that off and then start this all over? And he's not clear there. Yes, over here. Thanks. Yeah.
Thanks. So I believe in a literal reading of Genesis, and I'm comfortable defending most questions. There are, however, two questions that I have trouble defending. And the first one is, on which deck in the ark were the dinosaurs? And the second question is, based on the premise that God cannot lie, would it not be a lie for God to give the illusion of light originating several million years ago, where if the universe indeed had a much shorter life?
Yeah. Take it in reverse order. The earliest date that I know that we can really come up with is Abraham's date, 2167, for his birth. But anything earlier than that, how far back is the flood or any of those events in Genesis 1 through 11, we don't know. The only thing I know is that it starts out in the beginning. There's an absolute beginning. But where was that on our calendars? I don't know, to give you a BC date. And you ask, were dinosaurs on the ark? And there again, I don't know. Everything depends on where Noah's flood is put. And along with that, I would caution, rather than talking about a literal reading, since I agree with you on 90% of that, there still are things in the narrative where I would say take a straightforward or natural reading or an ordinary reading of the text might be a little better way to say that, because some take modern day definitions and affix them to some of those terms, and that is not always what the original writer might have had in mind. But otherwise, I agree with the emphasis there. But my great problem is I don't know where you would put the Ark 3000, 6000, where, I don't know. And the great difference between a physical anthropologist and archaeologist has always been clear. Archaeologists can get sites in Jericho for 7,500 to 8,500 years before the Christian era, but that's nowhere near where the physical anthropologists wanted to go. So the two sciences haven't met yet. Other questions? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Would you give some comments on Genesis 1, 2, and the gap theory and the age of the universe?
I began as a young believer with the gap theory. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Does that sound good or bad? Well, that's good. Now, the earth was without form and void, tohu vavohu, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And so I just wondered there. And we were told in those early days, well, that's where there was an earlier creation, and God brought destruction, and then verse 3 starts, and God said, and started all over. But that was based on one word, and that is that the earth became without form and void. And it is true, in English, our was can be the word to be or become, but not in Hebrew. You have haya, which is the present tense verb of is or was or were. But when you want to say to become, there is a very clear expression, haya plus le, the preposition. That is not there. That seemed to be the death knell of the gap theory. Yeah. Other question? Yes.
Somewhat in the same vein, I don't know if you're aware that Hugh Ross kind of references you as one who might be supportive of his views in terms of a very old universe.
Yeah. And I've worked with Hugh Ross on John Ankerberg shows and things like that, yeah. And Hugh is an astrophysicist, and so he comes at it with a starry background. Yeah. Go ahead, I'm teasing.
I guess it seems the, in terms of wrestling to both understand Scripture and take a stance in the world, it's difficult. Young Earth creation view is very strong in evangelicalism, and one is almost seen as a heretic if one doesn't adopt that view. And then the scientific community is full-fledged in an extremely, you know, 14 billion years for the universe and about 4.5 for the Earth.
Yeah.
There seems to be an ability to embrace both the, you know, the longevity of the, you know, secularist perspective with a literary understanding of Genesis, with the first verse in Genesis 1:1 being an overview statement, and then the process is laid out. Could be embracing long periods of time, sort of the day-age theory. Do you feel that somehow the evangelicalism can survive some of the intramural battles and then still have a place to speak into the world?
We've got to learn how to talk with each other and be Christians. There are verses on that. I beseech Euodia and Syntyche, which Vernon McGee used to always say, I beseech Thinky and Soon Touchy to get along. And I say the beginning of the world, when they ask me the date, is in the beginning. But I won't get any sharper than that. It was an absolute beginning. How many years are there involved? And now we get into astrophysics and we talk about light and light years. And then we go into some who are saying, no, but God created those stars with light on the way. And then we start talking, yes, but what about trees? Well, he made them with rings on so that they have age. Well, then what about Adam and Eve? Did they have belly buttons and navels, you see? And so all of this is just to get into the argument. This will surprise you. The evidence of the early church, up until we have the start of the science of geology with Lyell, L-Y-E-L-L, the majority opinion of the church was long periods of time. And why? It was Augustine who really pushed that, and Augustine had about three, four reasons. I'll give you the ones I remember. First of all, he said there were three yomim days before God made 24-hour days on the fourth day. That was strong enough to carry the church all the way up to the 1700s. And then, secondly, he argued that the seventh day never had closure. And in Hebrews, it's arguing that that day is still on. So that was a second one of Augustine's arguments and so forth. But look, the point is, I don't know of much in theology that's hanging on whether it is 24 hours or a long period of time. I think that what we are doing is giving contemporary values to words in the biblical text when we don't have a dictionary to help us with that. And therefore, we need to be gentle with each other and respectful and give some leeway. And listen, we're about ready to divide the church up on whether it's 6 days or a long period of time, when there are questions of far greater importance with getting the gospel out in this day and age. Why not say the Bible says it was in the beginning, and I'm committing to God the best way to understand that. And when people ask me, I have an opinion, but it's my opinion. And it's not one that I can close off. If we could close it off, we would have closed it off. But we can't close it off. And those are things that eat up the church. And there are other things where God has made it more explicit. Now, it may sound like a cop-out, but for an absolute beginning is really required with regard to supernaturalism and the eternality of God, not the eternality of matter and on being and becoming. all those sorts of things. But nothing that I know of hangs on that, unless it be, would you support my work because God's raised us up in these latter days, emphasize this, neglect the truth. Now, I was a fundraiser. I had to raise money for a seminary, and they told me, you're president. And I said, I am. I never said yes, and I never did. For 9 years, I never said yes. I never signed anything. But they also told me, we have a capital campaign, and we want to raise $54 million. I said, 54 what? I've never seen one. So you want 54 of those, whatchamacallit, million. But God was gracious. I don't know how. We saw almost $70 million in 9 years. So go figure, except God is gracious. Well, at any rate, back here. Thanks.
Yes, several years back, I attended a seminar where they had the creationists and the evolutionists kind of going at each other.
Yeah.
And the bottom line was that a lot of the evolutionists were arguing that, you know, they had found X number of bones and they put something together, and there was still always a missing link. Anyway, I was in Galapagos Islands in Ecuador, and they had the Darwin Research Center there. Yeah. And they had a big poster of a little bird, maybe like a finch size, you know, like a finch. And they argued that the evolution process, and he ended up an eagle, you know. And then my basic, when people asked me, and one of the tourist guides asked me what I thought about it, I said, well, you know, they focus on that. What did the giraffe evolve from? Rhinoceros. You know, they have the big giant tortoise. Where? And I went to the Grand Canyon, and they, you know, they talk about the evolutionary process and how the Colorado River was supposed to have, you know, built, I mean, ended up with the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
And I said, well, then what does the Colorado River have to do with, I mean, that's got something that other rivers don't have? I mean, how come all the rivers are not creating a Grand Canyon?
Yeah.
And that's how I, when they have asked me, I have gone back to that. I mean, we focus on the human body because, you know, humans have to evolve from some kind of a this or that. But, I mean, why don't they focus on all the species of all the animals and have an answer to that, you know?
Yeah. The reference you make to is the Archaeopteryx, where they thought they had a intervening theme between a opinions of a bird and that of a snake. And Archaeopteryx, the one slate palette that they had of that was supposed to be one of these missing links. They've worked very, very hard to fill in those major gaps that go on species and genus, family and order, but really go class and phyla and kingdom, where you're going from fish that come up on land, become reptiles, which become amphibians, which then become birds, which then become mammals, which then become primates, which then become men and women. And that's the issue. The new thing that's been added is that the lineup of the genes on the 23 chromosomes in the human pair are extremely like those, for example, the chimpanzee. Extraordinary. And even of our, they're getting so they can tell our ancestral lineage because of the way in which the genes have lined up. But we argue back, at least I have, saying that it is the Creator God who is magnificent, and you can always tell his work, in which it has much the same pattern, just like a Frank Lloyd Wright building would have. And so I think we need to both assert, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. Then go to those texts and show there's an absolute beginning, show that there was a method and God said, and show that apparently there were some forms of evil and death that was prior to the special space in the Garden of Eden which God had made for them to be tried, but even Satan was there, that old dragon, the serpent, and that's the one in Romans 16 where it finally says there, God says, I will put enmity between you, Hanahash, and the woman, between the serpent's seed and the woman's seed. And now look out. Here comes the serpent's going to take one of the male descendants of the woman, and that male descendant, not she, not it, as in the King James, not she as in the Douay, but he will crush the head of the serpent. And Romans 16 says, now may the God of peace crush Satan under the feet of all of you shortly. So it's going back. And did Eve understand? Oh, did she ever? Now, Adam knew Eve, his wife, that's cardinal knowledge, and she became pregnant and she bore a son and she called him God because she says, I've gotten the man, even the Lord. It's I've gotten the man, comma, et Yahweh. Now, our texts all say, with the help of the Lord. But there's no help of the Lord. German Bible, Luther had it right. Even the Lord. Her instincts were right that God would send a truly human, truly divine person who would crush the head of the serpent. Her timing was way off. Her timing is way off, just like many who write on the second coming. We had at the seminary when I was dean, Lois Armstrong came in and she said, honestly, I'm going to quit. I said, Lois, what's wrong? She said, we have had 30 phone calls wanting to know what you would say, whether Jesus is coming back September 13th, 14 on 1988. 88 reasons why he's coming back in 88. That book's on sale now. But there was another one too, head of a network, and he said Jesus coming back 1994, which he's revised now, which is May 21st, 2011. I planned, like I told Lois, I said, Lois, take a note. She said, oh, honestly. She went out, got her pad, came back in. She says, what is it? I said, concerning the Lord coming back September 13, 14. She looked at me quizzically. I said, write it down. And I said, the dean is preparing a definitive statement. And she now was put her hands on her hip. I said, go ahead, put down. I said, this will be released on September 15th. And she said, honestly, threw the pad down and went out.
Last question. Real quick.
Yes.
With, you know, all of us wanting to encourage that respectful kind of in-house debate among old earth and young earth viewpoints, there's the one, as we're teaching through Genesis right now, a question that I've had a couple of times come up in the last couple of weeks is related to the idea of death before the fall, the death of other forms of creation, and I was just wondering if you could speak to that theologically. It seems to be a good argument to me, and I don't know exactly how to address that with people as well as I wish I could.
If you notice, I snuck a piece of information in, saying that in verse 2, mm-hmm. Now the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the earth, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, that sounds like there has been a catastrophe of some sort that has come there. And I put the Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, Jude 7, 2 Peter 2, and saying that's where the enemy came from, Hanahash, because you have to have a principle of evil in the garden too. I mean, he's evil. Whatever else you're going to say, whether it's the devil or not, it's really evil. I don't know. We try our best, but we've got to be kind to one another because we're not inspired. I've said to my classes many times, some of you know this, I'm not a prophet. My father was a farmer, so I'm not a son of a prophet. And I've worked all my life for nonprofit organizations. So and John is the first one to come forward. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Dr. Kaiser.